This is lecture number 2 by Alan McCrae, his Prophecies of Daniel, lecture number 2. Now, we were speaking last time about chapter 2, the setting of the prophecy of Daniel. We noticed that there is no reason to think that it was necessarily an arbitrary action on a part of Nebuchadnezzar's part to say what he did. I think we are quite justified in concluding that he had been fooled by these so-called wise men, and therefore he said, quote, "This decision is firm from me," end quote. Now the word firm only occurs in this chapter, and so the way that it was guessed at before, the comment, quote, "The word has gone from me," end quote, could just as well mean exactly the same thing as, quote, "This is the word that I have given," end quote. In fact, that word, is often used for a command. But the way it's stated in the King James Version, in two different verses, it could suggest that Nebuchadnezzar meant that he had forgotten the dream. I don't believe that there is any necessity to take it as he had forgotten it, even if the word means gone out from me. That means the command had gone out, not the dream had gone out of his brain. But it is quite generally recognized, as I mentioned to you last time, that in at least one of these places, the word is a word which means firm. Now, I just received a question if that's true in both cases that the word is used, but unfortunately, I didn't bring my Aramaic with me this morning, so I'll have to look it up later, but it is my impression that this word means the same thing in both of the cases in which it is used. Now, we also began to look at Nebuchadnezzar's vision, and we noticed Nebuchadnezzar was king from 605-52 BC, and his vision has two parts. First, there is a static picture. There is a statue with three parts. Then we noticed that it has a dynamic series of events, and I asked you to look at those events for the assignment for today. We will not immediately get into that discussion of them, but I hope that I can get to that before the end of the hour. Now, outline letter capital C, quote, "the interpretation," end quote, and under that is number 1, quote, "the meaning of the statue," end quote. And there I think it is important that we have in mind that if God gave a person a dream, and the dream showed a statue in front of him, which was made up of 5 different kinds of metal, that you would have no basis whatsoever to make any guess as to what this meant. Some people have suggested that the statue was the basis for the statue described in the next chapter that Nebuchadnezzar set up on the plain of Dura and told everybody to worship. Now, that's purely a guess. We have no reason to say that the statue relates to the one that we see later, but you would have no basis to have any idea what the statue meant and what the progression of events from the head down to the feet meant. It might just as well mean a progression of events from the feet up to the head. Or it might mean a situation that was present at that time. It might represent various nations of that particular time or various types of people or various languages. It might represent something about mining the materials in the statue or general plans for the advance of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. In other words, without revelation, we really don't know what the statue means. There would be absolutely no way to have any idea what the statue meant, except that we have the interpretation that is given. And when we have the interpretation given, then we can immediately know that it represents a series of historical events, starting with the head and moving down to the foot. Then we could, if we're so inclined, make guesses as to what each part of the statue means. For instance, he said to Nebuchadnezzar, quote, "You are this head of gold," end quote. Well, does that mean that Nebuchadnezzar, being the head, had better eyesight than anyone else in his kingdom because the statue had eyes of gold? Does it mean he had better hearing than anybody else in the kingdom? Does it mean he had a better mind than any ruler who would rule after him? There's all kinds of guesses we could make from parts of the statue, but that would be purely guesswork. Now, we move a little further in the statue and we find that the breast and arms are made of silver. As you look at the breast and the arms, you have three parts. You have two arms, and I suppose the hands would be included, but we can't say for sure whether the hands are included or whether the hands belong with the next part down. What do the fingers mean? What does it mean that there is a central body and two arms? Are there going to be three parts to the next kingdom? There are all kinds of guesses that we could make, but we have no basis for them unless we're specifically told something about them in Scripture. Then there's a third part, which is of bronze. Of bronze is a better translation than the King James, which says of brass, unless you want to say copper, which would be equally good. Brass, as it is in the King James, is an old English word, and that is unfortunate. The Hebrew word simply means copper, and it can stand for copper itself or an alloy of copper. That would be brass, but we think of it rather as bronze than brass. But it is a common alloy of copper that was used in antiquity. Bronze, by the way, was very strong and was widely used for weapons, and earlier used for digging tools as well, but later all this was replaced by iron. Brass or bronze is stronger than silver. Perhaps silver is a slightly better conductor of electricity than bronze, but I don't think either of those facts tells us anything about the meaning of the statue. We notice that the third part includes the belly and the thighs. That would mean that it would reach from the middle, the trunk, down to about the knees. Does that mean that the third kingdom is going to be originally one and then divide into two parts? We have no basis in the account to lead us to think so. Then we have the legs, which are of iron, and it is quite generally thought that the legs stand for the Roman Empire. And some people say that the fact that there are two legs indicates the eastern and the western parts of the Roman Empire. I don't think we have any more warrant for that than for the previous statement, particularly as we realize that the Roman Empire lasted for 4 centuries and was almost ready for its downfall before its division into two parts. And so I just want to warn against this type of reading into the meaning of the statue. It may have meaning beyond what is suggested in the text, but we don't have any warrant for accepting those meanings. We may, as we find other parallels somewhere else in the Bible, have a right to look back and say, here's something that fits in with something in the history that fits in with something else that was later predicted in Daniel. But at this point, I'm particularly anxious that we look at it from the viewpoint of what do we have in this chapter, not what do we have in this chapter and every place else that we can look. We think of Nebuchadnezzar and of Daniel. What would they find there? We may find points suggested which are clarified later in Daniel or in the New Testament. In such a case, if you note particular things like that, you might take a note of them and bring them to our attention later. Make a note of anything that occurs to you where you think something later in the Bible pertains to what we are doing here. But at this point, we're interested in seeing what we have here and what can legitimately be drawn from this without looking further forward in the Scripture. We are justified, I think, at this point, in looking at the future history to see how it fits in with it, however. Now then, number 2 of the outline, quote, the parts of the statue in general, end quote. What has specific meaning and what is only part of the picture, that is what I was just speaking of. As for number 3, quote, what do the metals signify, end quote. Well, we are told, quote, you are this head of gold, end quote. But beyond that, the head of gold stands for Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think we have a right to say that it means that the Babylonian kingdom had any more gold than any of the later kingdoms, or that it was a more powerful kingdom, or that it was a greater kingdom. It's simply the first of the metals. It doesn't say anything about a difference in meaning between the gold and the silver. The silver is next, and then the bronze, and then the iron. Now the iron, we do have evidence that it has a specific meaning. It says that the iron is strong and it breaks everything. Similarly, this kingdom represented by iron will be strong. So we have 4 kingdoms here mentioned, of which the 4th one is to be very strong. And of course, the art of warfare would gradually improve through those years. The Persians, for instance, were able to make tremendous conquests because of their ability with shooting arrows. They would shoot great clouds of arrows and just nothing could stand before them. But then the Greeks came under Alexander the Great, and they were encased in heavy armor, and standing close together with the strong armor, they could hold back the arrows from injuring them. And they had a step forward in the art of warfare. So we might say that the iron represents a stronger force than any previous one, another step forward in warfare. How much beyond that it goes, we don't know. But we do know that the iron stands for strength. And then there is the clay mixed with iron in the feet and the toes. The clay we are told more about, and we'll get to look at that later. Now outline letter capital D, quote, the five parts of the statue, end quote. As of this chapter, I will just refer to four kingdoms. As it is stated here, you could not tell whether there are four kingdoms or five kingdoms when you include the feet. I have not noticed anything here that would indicate which. There are five parts. The fourth and the fifth have a similarity, that one of them is entirely of iron, and the other is partly of iron and partly of clay. Are they the same kingdom, or are they two distinct kingdoms? I don't think you can decide that simply from chapter 2, unless someone eventually calls my attention to something that I haven't quite noticed yet. But I do think it can be definitely decided when we get to chapter 7 as to what the feet and the feet and the clay mean. So for the present, I think we should say that we do not know whether there are four kingdoms or five kingdoms. There are definitely five parts to the statue, but we don't know whether that represents five kingdoms. We look at number 1 under capital D, quote, the starting point is Nebuchadnezzar, end quote. We have a remarkable series of statements that Daniel makes to Nebuchadnezzar in verses 36 and 37. I'd like to read those as they stand in the King James Version. Quote, Daniel said, this is the interpretation, end quote. We'll tell his interpretation before the king as we read on. Quote, you king, meaning Nebuchadnezzar, are the king of kings, where the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls in heaven have been given by the divine hand and made you ruler over them all. End quote. Does that mean that Nebuchadnezzar had a power that none of us have in order to order the birds of the heavens around in which direction to fly and tell them to change their migratory progress as we may choose? It sounds to me like flattery given to Nebuchadnezzar. God has given the fowls of heaven into his hands and him made ruler over all of them. I'm sure that the birds could fly over Babylonia and go wherever they wanted to go, and Nebuchadnezzar could do very little about it, unless they flew rather low. And there's many a beast of the field that he could not possibly control or do anything about. So when we read, quote, you are this head of gold, end quote, we can ask a question here. Are Daniel's words to Nebuchadnezzar inerrant? I believe very definitely in the inerrancy of Scripture, that whatever God has given to us in the Scripture about any subject we can stand upon, accept, and believe that it is true. But I think we have to be very careful. When Daniel gives Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation that God has given to Daniel, we can certainly accept every word that he says as being absolutely true and without error. But when he flatters Nebuchadnezzar a little bit as he begins to tell him what this dream means, I would question just how far we can go in saying that that is a true description of Nebuchadnezzar's rule. Quote, wherever the children of men dwell, end quote. Were there Indians in the United States at that time? Were they under Nebuchadnezzar's control too? Were there great civilizations in Mexico or Peru at that time? Were there no peoples in China at that time? We have very considerable evidence that there were great numbers of people in these areas, some of them possessing rather high civilizations, and none of them probably even heard of Nebuchadnezzar. I say probably because most likely there was commercial traffic between Babylon and Egypt and China, and at this time it might be that word of Nebuchadnezzar may have spread beyond Babylonia because of the trade between various empires. But these are the introductory words to the statement that is made that is part of the interpretation. Quote, you are this head of gold. The head of gold stands for you, end quote. But as for the flattering words that he gives to Nebuchadnezzar, it is absolutely true that that is what Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar. But that Daniel's words express exact truth, I think would be carrying inerrancy beyond what it means. Well, now number 2. Here's an interesting question. Quote, what is meant by this head of gold? Is it Nebuchadnezzar? Is he the head of gold? End quote. Well, immediately, when I ask these questions, you can turn to the sheet of paper that I have given you here with a few facts on it. I'm not giving these facts for you to memorize. There may be some of them you think important and try to remember them, but these are facts that will be useful in connection to today's lecture and with many subsequent lectures during the course. so please keep the sheet and have it with you when we want to refer to it. Now you'll notice I mentioned the New or Neo-Babylonian Empire on the sheet. There had been a great power from Babylon many centuries before Nebuchadnezzar, which had wielded control over a very large area. And then that had been overcome by the Assyrians, who followed the Babylonian culture very closely. So closely that we can think of them as one civilization, the Assyrians and the Babylonians together. And for some centuries, Babylon was subject to Assyria, with its capital first at Assur, then at Nineveh. During those centuries, Babylon was constantly trying to gain its independence, but there was a close similarity of culture, of type of people, and of language between these two civilizations. Eventually, the Babylonians gained their independence. As I've mentioned before, they overthrew the Assyrian army by the forces of Nebuchadnezzar and the Medes. Now, whether I should have said of Nebuchadnezzar, I'm not quite sure, because this was in 604 that Nebuchadnezzar was a great force. 614, however, is the date that is given for the destruction of Assur, and it was probably done by Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar. His father had been governor of Babylon when Babylonia was under the Assyrians, but he had revolted. And then a group of peoples to the east of them, who are called the Medes, had a rather loose confederacy. These different tribes joined together with the father of Nebuchadnezzar in 614, and they destroyed the old capital of Assyria at Assur. 2 years later, they were able to conquer Nineveh, which had been the capital for about a century. And they destroyed Nineveh in 612 BC. They destroyed it so completely that until 150 years ago, no one even knew where Nineveh had been located, and it was one of the greatest cities of ancient times. But a large group of the Assyrians fought on after that, and it really wasn't until 604 BC when Nabopolassar's son, Nebuchadnezzar, was leading the army. In fact, it was a year after Nabopolassar died that Nebuchadnezzar and the Medes together put a complete end to the Assyrian domination. And some of the Assyrian territory was taken over by the Medes, but the greater part of the territory was taken over by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar reigned from 605-562 BC. He was unquestionably one of the great figures of ancient time, a great ruler and a great warrior. He deserved all the praise that he was given. Quote, "You, Nebuchadnezzar, are this head of gold," end quote. Then it says in verse 39, quote, "After thee shall rise another kingdom, and another third kingdom of bronze, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron," end quote. Well, when Nebuchadnezzar died in 562, he was succeeded by his son Amel-Marduk, who reigned for 2 years, but who proved not to be very satisfactory as a ruler, and so he was assassinated, and a general who married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, Nergal-Sharezer, succeeded him. His name is sometimes shortened to Nergal-Sharezer, and he ruled 4 years, and then was succeeded by his son, who was also very unsatisfactory, and was soon removed. And then a man named Nabonidus became king. Now, does this mean that the breast and arms represent Amel-Marduk, who reigned 2 years, and the belly and thighs represent Nergal-Sharezer? Certainly neither Amel-Marduk nor Nabonidus would be worthy to be represented as a great force as iron. So we must say that when it says, quote, "You are the head, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold, and after you will rise another kingdom," end quote, that this is either jumping ahead, that is, there is a gap there between Nebuchadnezzar's death and the coming of this other kingdom some years later, around 539, or about 23 years later, or else that when it says, quote, "You are the head of gold," end quote, it represents not simply Nebuchadnezzar, but the empire over which he is the temporary head. And so, as between these two, I'm inclined to think that the second is the more likely interpretation, that this does not represent Nebuchadnezzar alone, but represents the Neo-Babylonian Empire. But then again, we raise a new question. The Neo-Babylonian Empire altogether only lasted from 605 to 539 BC. The Persian Empire lasted 2 centuries, the Hellenistic Empire lasted about 2 centuries, and the Roman Empire lasted for somewhere between 4 and 6 centuries. When you say, quote, you are this head of gold, end quote, does it mean just the Neo-Babylonian kingdom, or is it the entire period, perhaps, of Assyrian-Babylonian power, a period of about 1,000 years in which great power was wielded by the Babylonians, the Assyrians, and again by the Babylonians? They were a closely related people, using the same language, the same type of writing, a closely related culture. Now, those are three possibilities, you see, and at this point, we cannot speak dogmatically on that. Personally, I'm inclined very much to the third interpretation, which is that it represents the entire Babylonian-Assyrian-Babylonian era. Now, this word, kingdom, is a word that isn't used much today. 60 years ago, we could speak of the Kingdom of Spain, the Kingdom of Portugal, the Kingdom of Greece, and the Kingdom of Italy. We had many kingdoms in the world. Today, the word kingdom is little used. By the word kingdom, we are referring specifically to the rule of one man, a king, or it may mean the power of a nation, a national power, a strong power. Well, the word kingdom is used in this particular chapter in a way that seems to me that is not what we mean by kingdom even 100 years ago, but what it means is more like what we mean by the term empire. That is, the word empire may not occur in the Bible, but when the Bible uses the term kingdom, it probably represents what we mean today by the word empire. This word empire originally just meant a military commander. The Roman troops, after a great battle, would sometimes hail their commander as Imperitatu, the emperor, par excellence, the man who gave the commands. From this word, imperator, we derive our word emperor. And so it developed from the great power of the Roman rulers, and it has been carried on since then. Usually it means someone who ruled much more than one nation. Thus the king of Germany during the Middle Ages, if he had sufficient power, would go to Rome and be crowned emperor by the Pope, and then he would call himself, quote, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, end quote, which was supposed to embrace Germany and Italy and all the regions in between. And if he was a very powerful man, he could march south several times and keep Italy under his control. It was a difficult job to do. And most emperors didn't succeed very well at the task. But the word emperor was considered a higher title than a king. So in modern times, I believe the word empire is like the word kingdom that is used in the Bible, and it refers not so much to a particular ruler as to a power. And when we think of an empire, we are apt to mean that more than one nation is involved, that one nation exercises control over another nation, or that one man exercises control over several nations. And I think most interpreters would feel convinced that that is what is meant by the various kingdoms here. In that, it is not a kingdom in the sense that we speak of the kingdom of Portugal or the kingdom of Spain or the kingdom of Greece and the kingdom of Italy, but that it means an empire. It means a power like Nebuchadnezzar had, where a group of different nations were all under his control and direction, and that the definition could be extended to include empire, even if rule was not a one-man rule, even if you had a senate or a group of leaders that controlled rather than one individual. Now, a third question here is, quote, is there a progression in the metals, end quote. Verse 39 says, quote, after you shall rise another kingdom inferior to you, and another third kingdom of bronze, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, end quote. Well, this certainly gives a suggestion the fourth kingdom is going to be the strongest of all. And so you think, if there's going to be a progression, it will be a progression in strength rather than weakness. And that would fit with the history because Nebuchadnezzar ruled over an area, you can see the map here, which would extend out to about this point, and it included Israel as well. So it's basically, he went from Babylonia west to Israel, and for a while there, he also went down to Egypt. He conquered Jerusalem about halfway through the millennium, and once he made a passage down to Egypt, but he held Palestine and Syria. He held Mesopotamia. The Medes were not under his control over there, nor the Persians just south of the Medes, in what is today called Iran, to the east of Iraq. He didn't control Asia Minor. There's much area that he did not control. But he did control a little bit more than what was controlled by Nebuchadnezzar. That is, the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus did control a little bit more than what Nebuchadnezzar controlled. Well, the Persians that followed him first got control over all the Medes, and then they conquered Asia Minor. Then Cyrus, the leading Persian, came back and conquered Babylon. He took over the empire that Nebuchadnezzar had. His armies went clear to India and conquered a part of India. And so the empire that followed Nebuchadnezzar was three times as large as Nebuchadnezzar's empire, and at least twice as large in population. And then Alexander the Great came from Greece. This area here had not been under the Persians at all. They conquered the whole Persian Empire, so their area was much larger. But the area that the Romans had added still more territory, so that if you speak of area, these empires certainly increased in size rather than diminished in size. Now, I should speak of populations. They increased in size instead of diminishing in size, as I said. Some have said there is a decrease in the preciousness of the metal that comprised the statue, but there's certainly no decrease in area. There's no decrease in population. Some claim the decrease must be because Nebuchadnezzar was an absolute despot, and then the next one gets weaker, and the next get weaker yet, and the next even weaker still. That idea has been advanced in recent years, but there's no basis for that because Nebuchadnezzar was not an absolute despot, even if it sounds so in the account of his relation with Daniel in this chapter. Nebuchadnezzar was very much bound by the laws of Babylon. In fact, there has been found in Babylon a great monument put up in the central square of Babylon that was put up by King Hammurabi more than 1,000 years before Nebuchadnezzar. The monument shows a picture of the sun god giving Hammurabi the laws at the top, and then tells people how the sun god gave him these laws and ordered him to put them up in the main square so that any citizen could come and read and know exactly what his rights were. Now, today, if you want to know what your rights are, you pay $100 to a lawyer to try to find out, and another lawyer may differ from the first, but in Babylon, the people had definite rights. Not nearly as many rights as individuals do in this country today, but they had definite rights. The power of the king, while very great, was not absolute. And in the various kingdoms, there was sometimes more autocracy and sometimes less, more democracy, sometimes less. You cannot show a progression in that regard. And so I was puzzled by the statement, quote, after you another kingdom shall rise inferior to you, end quote. And so I asked the question, quote, is this inferior a correct translation, end quote. And I looked at the Aramaic and I found that the Aramaic has this word erka, which corresponds to the Hebrew word eretz, which means earth. And it has an ending which means towards. The word occurs, I believe, only in this place in the Aramaic of the Bible. Literally, it means, quote, towards the earth, end quote. I had been told this 30 years ago by the man who was professor of Aramaic at the University of Chicago. He was making up a complete list of all the words in all the Aramaic inscriptions that had been found at that time and all the Aramaic literature that had been preserved. And so I wrote to that professor of Aramaic and I asked him, quote, could you tell me, from this list, whether there is any other case you can call my attention to where this word means inferior, end quote. And he replied, quote, I know of no case where, in the context, the word means inferior, end quote. He said, and I quote again, as far as the list of all Aramaic words is concerned, I know of no such thing here, end quote. And so it may be that the former professor took this knowledge with him when he retired. I don't know. But however, he said it. It is perfectly obvious here in Daniel that it means inferior. Now, I don't think you can decide what the Lord means even if the meaning of this word is perfectly obvious. The word means towards the earth. But the Persian kingdom was not inferior to the Babylonian kingdom. It was superior to it in many regards. And if this simply means, quote, towards the earth, end quote, that is, the word translated inferior might mean towards the earth, I think he is simply speaking of the place on the statue. Quote, you are the head of gold, and after you will be another kingdom, which is lower down on the statue, end quote. And I say lower down on the statue rather than inferior to you. And when he says there will be after it another kingdom of bronze, now the third kingdom wasn't specifically bronze. In fact, they were using mostly iron and weapons by that time. but it means that it is represented by bronze on the statue. And so to take it as meaning that there is a progression and they are getting weaker or inferior is reading into the scripture on the basis of a translation of one word, and that translation is not even warranted. It is lower down on the statue. It is not inferior. There are four kingdoms which actually increase in strength and in size rather than decrease. Now, number four, quote, the second, third, and fourth kingdoms, end quote. I've already mentioned, in fact, what they would seem to be. On the sheet that I gave you, it explains Cyrus the Persians conquered the Medes. When he became king over a group of Persians, they were subject, to some extent, to the loose confederation of the Medes. In fact, he married the daughter of the king of the Medes, but eventually he declares his independence of them, and then he fought them and overcame them and put them under his control and led them to conquer other nations around. And they came to the west and north of Babylon, and then they went up and conquered the whole of Asia Minor. And after they had conquered all that territory, a territory much larger than the area that Nebuchadnezzar had, then Cyrus turned southward and went against Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom in 539 BC, 20 years after Nebuchadnezzar's death. At that point, Cyrus the Persian conquered Babylon. And so we have this second kingdom of Cyrus the Persian. I've mentioned certain dates under him. 559 BC, he became king. 546 BC, he conquered Asia Minor. 539, he conquered Babylon. And in 529, he died. There's quite a bit on this chart that relates to later chapters, not just to this chapter, but after him, that is after Cyrus, came the Hellenistic or Greek Empire, and then it was followed by the Roman Republic or the Roman Empire. I want to mention the critical theory again at this point. We have referred to it before. We are not in this course trying to prove the authenticity of Daniel. We accept it as part of the Bible, as part of that upon which the Lord Jesus Christ set his seal as being authentic and genuine. But as I mentioned last time, Porphyry, in the 3rd century AD, advanced the theory that the book of Daniel was not written at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but written in the time of the Hellenistic Empire, at a time of great crisis for the Jews. We'll look into this later as it connects to later chapters. But at that time, that is the Hellenistic period, somebody wrote Daniel and described past history as if it were a prediction. But now you notice the difficulty and meaning that the critics have there, that the Hellenistic Empire is the third of these empires. And so the critics all say that the man who wrote the book of Daniel thought that there was first the Babylonian Empire, then the Median Empire, and then the Persian Empire, and now the Greek Empire in his own day that he calls the Fourth Empire. And actually, as we mentioned, Cyrus had the Medes entirely under his control, and they formed part of his army before he destroyed the Babylonian Empire. So the critics say that the writer was mistaken in his idea of the history, but on most things, he's so accurate that it must be that it was written later rather than earlier. Incidentally, remember that the phrase that occurs in the book of Esther and also here, the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which combines the two as one power? Well, in Daniel chapter 5, where it tells of the destruction of the conquest of Babylon, it says that, quote, your kingdom is given to the Medes and the Persians, end quote. So to say that Daniel believed in a separate Median empire is simply contrary to the facts. To the critics, there were the Medians, a kingdom of the Medes, and then the Persians, and then the Greeks, but the Medes and the Persians are historically one empire. Now, outline letter capital E, quote, the fifth part of the statue, end quote. Under number one, I raise the question, quote, are there four kingdoms or five, end quote. I don't think we could tell from the book of Daniel. He says the fourth kingdom will be strong as iron. And verse 41 we read, quote, whereas you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall divide, end quote. What does he mean by that? The next kingdom or the same kingdom? I don't think you could prove one or the other from this chapter, but I think you'll find conclusive evidence about it when we get a little further on in the book of Daniel, specifically chapters 7 and on. But now let's look at number 2 of the outline, quote, the symbolic meaning of the potter's clay, which of course means weak or brittle, end quote. When we think of clay, we think of something like mud. The statue just couldn't stand up if it just had mud for its feet. It's quite obvious that what he means is potter's clay. In other words, it is clay that has been fired or dried in the sun or baked in the furnace and therefore becomes what we know of as china or pottery. It is something that can stand up by itself if you could put a fair amount of weight on it, but nothing like the weight that you could put on iron. And so it means that the feet have clay interspersed with the iron. They have this material which is brittle, which is easily broken, which is not strong like iron, of the fifth part. Now, number three, quote, does the statement in verse 43 simply mean an unintegrated mixture of people? What is the character of this last part, end quote. The kingdom shall be divided, quote, there shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with the miry clay, and the toes and the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay, end quote. Does that simply mean an unintegrated mixture of peoples? Something like the present nation of Israel is, where you have a large part of the area with mostly Jews speaking Hebrew, and then you have another large section under the control of peoples who are mostly Arab with a very different culture? Is it the sort of picture that is described here? Is it like Switzerland today, where you have about 60% speaking German and maybe 25% speaking French? One day I walked from the German section just 5 miles through the woods into the French section. I couldn't find a person in the town that could even speak German. So distinct is the line, and yet they are one nation. Does this mean simply an unintegrated mixture of peoples, or does it mean something more than that? If that's all it means, an unintegrated mixture of people, it would fit the whole history of each of these empires. The Babylonians had various peoples mixed together. They transported people away from their homes to another section of the land and carried some of the people from that section to yet another. And so they had these people mixed together and all having to look to the Babylonian king for protection from other groups. Does it simply mean unintegrated mixture of peoples? If so, it could fit the Babylonian Empire. It could fit the Persian Empire, which had so many different peoples in it that Xerxes led a tremendous army to conquer Greece, and they had maybe 40 different languages spoken by the soldiers, and it was very difficult to communicate or to organize them together into much smaller groups. With extra good weather and very unusual circumstances, the Greeks were able to prevent them from conquering them. And so this could fit the Persian Empire. Certainly the Hellenistic Empire had many different groups in it, not very well assimilated together either. And certainly the Roman Empire did as well. So the possibility remains that verse 43 describes something that is not obvious. We first see this later on, but at the present, I simply give it as a problem. Exactly what does verse 43 mean? Now, we have noticed that in this chapter, we have noticed that we have a symbol given. We have the statue, and we have the three dynamic occurrences. The stone breaks away from the mountain without human hands. The stone hits the statue, utterly destroys it, and the stone grows until it becomes a whole nation. Now, all of this is symbolic. It is strictly figurative. But then, when you get to the interpretation is nearly all literal and in plain language. Such as, quote, you are the head of gold, end quote. In other words, it stands for you. After you will come another kingdom. Further down the statue, a kingdom which will rule the whole earth, and then the third kingdom, and then there will be a fourth kingdom. This ends lecture number 2 of the Prophecies of Daniel by Alan McRae.